The fish is a very difficult fish to catch. It really tries the patience of almost any angler because it's a very wary fish. You have to use very light leaders, quarter, half pound leader for a fairly good sized fish, a very, very small hook. And their favorite bait in the state of Washington are the small grubs that live in decaying wood. Use a very minute hook and entirely bury the hook in the grub. Use a very light leader and let that grub bounce along the bottom of the stream. And in a fast stream, you get a 16 or 17 inch whitefish on your line with a quarter or a half pound test leader, and you've got to be a good fisherman to get him in. Very good fisherman. The next fish we'll discuss are the pike, Esox lucius. Its common names are the northern pike, jack pike, the fish, snake, and almost any cuss word you want to use.
Is that the same pike
you
see up northern Minnesota on those lakes?
Yes.
Game fish there.
Yes, so are carp in many sections of the Midwest. Yeah, the pike is not listed as a game fish in Alaska, but it is angled for as a sport fish at the present time, and I think that it is a valuable resource to the interior. And I'm bringing it out this time. It's the most widely distributed fish that we have in the interior of Alaska. It's found in practically every watershed that we have in the interior. Interior. The pike in Alaska are slow growing. They spawn in the early spring. If you go out on these lakes when the ice is still out in the lake, but the shoreline, the ice has been melted away from the shoreline for several hundred feet out, you can see the pike in there spawning. Their backs might be half exposed above water, and they'll be riffling over the top of the water, fighting and spawning in there. Spawn in the very early spring. The young hatch out in a matter of days, and they start feeding on insects and small crustaceans. Small crustaceans, then insects. As soon as they get to be about 2.5 inches long, they demand large coarse feed in order to obtain any size. By large coarse feed, I mean forage fish, some type or another. If there are no other species of fish in the lake, they eat their own. They eat other pike. In the lakes that I've checked, the rate of growth is slow. They grow to about 4.5 inches during the first summer or first growing season. And a 5 or 6 year old pike will be 17 to 20 inches long. Now, that's one of the things the thing that makes most people get discouraged with pike is they catch pike that are 12, 13, 14, 15 inches long, and they don't put much of a battle on the tackle, and when you go to clean them, all you've got is or head, backbone, and asshole, I figure. So, you've got to get a fairly good-sized pike before you get any fishing. I think you've got to get a pike around 25 inches long or 5 pounds before you have much meat. We have a freshwater codfish. It's called a ling or burbot. It presently isn't being utilized in the sport fishery in Alaska. Its range is very extensive throughout the interior and is found in some of the coastal drainages. And I feel that this fish too will enter into the sport fishery at some time in the future. And the last fish that I know of that's used in sport fishery in Alaska is the shefish or inconu. I don't know too much about this, the she-fish, except that it's fished in, up in the Bering Sea region and in the Arctic. It's found all the way up the Yukon to about Eagle. And it is caught locally in the Tanana to a minor extent.
The diagram of the territory goes over the range of these fish. I know in Alaska. Kind of hard to visualize unless you have some sort of picture. This is going to be crude and diagrammatic, as you can see. Here we have Ketchikan and Juneau, Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, Kenai, Kodiak, the Fog Neck, Alaskan Peninsula, Bristol Bay, Aleutian Islands, North and South Seward Peninsula, Kotzebue, the Arctic, and the Yukon and Tanana Rivers. We'll take them up by areas and list the sport fish found in each area. In southeastern Alaska, we'll include all that area from the southernmost boundary of Alaska, the Panhandle, to the Prince William Sound area. It'll be all that area that drains into the Pacific from the southernmost boundary up to Prince William Sound. This area is characterized by heavy rainfalls, a moderate climate, streams that vary tremendously in their fluctuation, water level. It's a wet, fairly warm area of Alaska. We find all five species of salmon in this area. Both species of trout, the rainbow and cutthroat, are caught throughout this area.
You have Dolly Varden, Eastern Brooks, with the Eastern Brooks primarily around the Juneau and Ketchikan area. I don't know of any Eastern Brooks north of those areas. There are no lake trout, to the best of my knowledge, through that country. There are no grayling. There are white fish to be found in the lakes and streams throughout the area. There are no pike and no sheafish. Then we'll go from Prince William Sound to Bristol Bay. We'll take it all the way from Prince William Sound around through Cookman and up the Alaskan Peninsula and up to Bristol Bay. This will include Kodiak and the Fog Neck Islands. Here we have again all our five species of salmon. We have rainbows, but no cutthroats. We're at the northernmost limit of our range of our cutthroat, coastal cutthroat trout, and we hit about Prince William Sound. They are found in a few of the streams in the Copper River drainage. Beyond that, we don't have any cutthroats. We have Dolly Vardens and lake trout, but no Eastern Brooks. We have grayling in a very few isolated cases. Grayling are caught in the Copper River drainage about Chitna. You run into them around Chitna, and they become increasingly abundant as you proceed north up to Summit and Paxton's and that area and through there. White fish are found throughout the entire area. There are a few pike in very localized cases, and there are no sheafish.
Well, the Sioux set in the river, it comes in that first inlet when you
Yeah.
Yeah, it does come in that
first. Yes, that's right.
Well, there's quite a few salmon goes up a bit and then the streams running in the Sioux set in the river.
It's a very valuable spawning stream. I said that, didn't I say that all five species of salmon are found throughout this area?
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, I meant to say it if I didn't.
Sir, on that last area, don't you find quite a few grayling around the Katmai area?
I don't believe so. There are some grayling. As we proceed in this next area, we'll get into grayling again. You see, we're on these, I'm not striking sharp lines of demarcation here. What I'm trying to do is show where they are abundant. Now, there'll be a certain lapping over. For instance, when I said that there were no pike, or very few pike in this area from Prince William Sound up to Bristol Bay, as you come in, the interior of Alaska is predominantly pike. Here you're predominantly your trout species and your chars. There'll be a certain lapping over in those cases, but certainly the pike are not typical of this area, or grayling aren't typical of this particular area.
Something else you said a while ago that I either don't understand or has me confused. Do all of Dolly Varden go to saltwater?
No. I said that you believe that the Dolly Varden were both freshwater residents and resident and anadromous. There are Dolly Varden that spend their entire life cycle in freshwater. Then there are other races of Dolly Varden that spend the freshwater period, the saltwater residence period, and then the freshwater residence period. Same thing as the steelhead or the sea run cutthroat. And you have different races there. Within that same genus and species. Are there any other questions? Maybe I'm going a little bit too fast. If you've got any questions, don't hesitate to interrupt because we'll pick up the loose ends.
Getting back to grayling a minute. The age of them when they spawn. How old
old would they be? About how long would they be before they spawn?
They'll be between 5 and 6 years of age, and they'll be about 12 inches long. Is that right, Frank? Any other questions? I should have mentioned that you can ask questions at any time, because as I go through this stuff, you probably have been asked questions by the men in your commands, and you'd like to get the dope here now. Well, maybe I can't answer them, but I'll certainly look it up for you if I can. The information is available.
You say that steelhead are not, would not be common then into the, say, in the Kodiak Island area?
Yeah, steelhead are common in Kodiak Island. That's I haven't mentioned a steelhead yet in this particular area that I'm discussing.
These rivers and lakes are full of grading up here, but I'm still confused on what happens to them when these streams and lakes freeze over. Isn't there a certain amount of hibernation or something?
That's your foot in the cart before the horse. let me go through this range, and then I'll go through a little bit of that and pick up the loose ends at the end. That's a subject all in itself. It's a very comprehensive subject all in itself. Well, in the Prince William Sound, we have our salmon, rainbows, no cutthroat, dolly and lake trout, no eastern brooks, grayling in a few isolated cases, whitefish are abundant, very few pike, and no sheafish to speak of, no sheafish that I know of. I'll take from Bristol Bay to Kotzebue Sound. Bristol Bay to Kotzebue Sound, that's a big chunk, big portion of Alaska. In here we find all five species of salmon, again. We have find rainbow or abundant. We have some steelhead in this area. You're approaching the northernmost limit of your steelhead. In fact, you are at the northernmost limit of your steelhead. Repeat it out here. Dolly and lake trout are common, very common throughout this area. In fact, the Bristol Bay people want to put both those species of fish on the list for commercial fish in Alaska. Since the dolly and lake trout throughout that area are not being utilized by the sportsmen, they feel like there would be a valuable resource if they could harvest by commercial fisheries. Grayling are found throughout this area, as well as whitefish. Pike are found in isolated cases, and this is the main fishery for the Inconivore. Sheafish spawn throughout this area. The sheafish is anadromous. It is both freshwater water resident sheafish and anadromous sheafish are found. The last area that we'll discuss is the Arctic. There is very meager data on the fish that are found in the Arctic. Most of it is hearsay information or old information that may or may not be reliable. And from the, I've never been to the Arctic, so I can't speak firsthand on that area of Alaska, but in filtering through the information, it appears that there are both there are pinks and dog salmon in the Arctic. There are no reds, silvers, or kings. So we've run out of the range of these latter three species of fish. There are no cutthroats or rainbows in the Arctic. Dollies are found there, as well as lake trout. There are no eastern brooks. Grayling are found in the Arctic. Freshwater residents, of course. And whitefish. Whitefish are fairly abundant. In fact, there was quite a bit of talk of developing a commercial fishery in one of the rivers in the Arctic last for the last 2 years, although the cost of transportation from that area to Fairbanks or Anchorage, the local markets, was prohibitive, so they dropped it.
What river was that?
Colville. Now, we'll take up some questions that you might have on any of the information that I presented. Any other questions?
You just get to the interior.
Oh, yeah. Gee, I missed the most important part. Well, the interior of Alaska, we'll count the interior of Alaska as the drainage of the Yukon and Tanana rivers. That will be south of the Brooks Range and north of the Alaskan Range. It's that broad belt of valley that extends all the way through the interior of Alaska. Here we have our salmon species. We have the king, silver, and dog primarily. We do not have any rainbows or cutthroats, with the exception of those that I stocked the last 2 years. But I'm talking about native fish now. Somebody questioned me? Did I hear a hoon somewhere? We have lake trout in isolated instances. Dolly Varden are found in isolated instances. They're quite rare, as a matter of fact, throughout the interior, and so are lake trout. There are no eastern brooks. Grayling are found extensively throughout the drainages of the Yukon and Tanana River, and almost exclusively in the stream systems. There are a few lakes that contain grayling. Whitefish are found in the lakes and streams throughout the interior. They're fairly widely distributed and quite abundant. The pike, of course, dominates the freshwater fish in Alaska, in the interior of Alaska. It's found in almost every river system and in almost all of the lake systems. The ling, or freshwater codfish, also has a wide distribution throughout the interior, and the sheafish or canoe are found in the Tanana and Yukon both. I think that covers it pretty well for the range and distribution. Or collectively, you people probably know more about the range of fish in Alaska than I do. Collectively, you've traveled over a lot more of the area of Alaska than I have. Very little been written up. Very little known about the various species in the Arctic. But I think that pretty well covers it over, with the exception of overlapping that may occur with these various species of fish. Now, there's one concept that I'd like to leave with you, and we'll mull around for a minute here in dealing with any fish or any cold-blooded animal almost. We'll limit it to fish. A fish is a cold-blooded animal, and it depends on its body temperature depends upon the temperature of the water in which it lives. Now, you and I, whether we live at the North Pole or at the equator, our temperature is constant, 8-point-something. We digest our food at a uniform rate. We grow at a uniform rate. Our children, when they're 6 years old, are a certain size. When they're 8, they're a little bit bigger. When they get 17, they're getting pretty good-sized kids. Their rate of metabolism is fairly fixed because of their body temperature.
However, with the fish, the temperature of the fish varies a great deal. During the summer months in the interior of Alaska, our water temperatures will get up well up into the 70s. In the winter months, the water is from 33 to 39 degrees. The fish have an optimum temperature at which they grow. Take an example, take example here between the largemouth black bass, which fish you are probably familiar, and any of the trout species. The trout will put on growth at 45 degrees and above. At 50 degrees, they'll put on an appreciable amount of growth. The black bass doesn't put on any growth below 65 degrees Fahrenheit. During the summer months, when the temperatures are high, the metabolic rate of the fish is high. The fish ingest lots of food and they grow. During the winter months, when the water is cold, they ingest very little food and they do not grow to any appreciable extent. So actually, our fish grow in spurts. They grow rapidly during the summer months, in the winter they don't grow at all. Now for that reason, we're very limited in the species of fish that can be successfully reared in Alaska. Our waters are notoriously cold. I've given you the temperature at which a black bass could grow in Alaska. Well, in many sections of the territory, the temperature never gets as high as 65 degrees. So it would be ridiculous to bring such a fish into this area. That same thing could be said for all our spiny rayed fish, all of the spiny rayed fish found in the States. They're out as far as Alaska is concerned. Now, in wintering over, I'll just discuss this point briefly with you. And in how these fish winter over during the winter months. The lakes during the summer months are stratified with the warm water on the top and the cold water on the bottom. Water reaches its maximum density, or is at its maximum density, at approximately 39 degrees Fahrenheit. During the summer months, you'll find the lakes will be stratified with water, let's say, of 65 degrees at the surface and 40 degrees at the bottom. You have plenty of oxygen in this top layer of warm water because of wind agitation and so on. That water's picking up the oxygen. There is an abundance of oxygen. But at the bottom of the lake may be devoid of oxygen, this layer of water here, because there's decomposition by organic material. You might have a relatively small amount of oxygen stored in this top level of water. But as the cold weather comes on, this top layer of water cools down to 39 degrees. And when it cools down to 39 degrees, it's much, much heavier than this 39 degree water and slightly heavier than the 40 degree water. So this cold water, saturated with oxygen, sinks down and displaces this water at the bottom and shoves it upward. Now this continues for a couple weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, before the lake freezes over. And when the lake finally freezes over, you find in almost every case that the lake temperature from top to bottom is 39 degrees or thereabouts. And the water from top to bottom is saturated with oxygen. Cold water will hold a great deal more oxygen than warm water. So we have this lake, fairly cold temperature, saturated with oxygen.
Now, when the lake freezes over during the winter months, we get an ice layer formed on the top of the lake. This ice layer formed on the top of the lake, it prevents the oxidation of the water or the absorption of oxygen by the water through a wave agitation from the atmosphere. So we've got that lake sealed in. This water is cold, it's saturated with oxygen. The fish in that lake, their metabolic rate has been cut down to a very, very small amount. They're breathing very little. They're utilizing very little oxygen. There's enough oxygen stored in this water to sustain fish life during our long winter months, which are from 7 to 8 months. Does that explain it?
Don't they feed free stock?
No, I'll tell you why they don't. I said water reached its maximum density at 39 degrees, right? 39 degrees in the bottom. The temperature up here, immediately under the ice layer, is 33, let's say. Now, if this water, it's possible, I'm not saying theoretically, now let's talk in theory alone. If this 33 degree water was heavier than the 39 degree water, it would
I will make a trip in there on the side and take out those two drums. And I said, oh, I'd be glad to pay you if you will do that. Well, he said, I can do it in the usual run of things. And so I hope those two gasoline drums are gone. So we tried to leave a camp as we found it. In fact, better than we found it. And that is a part of wilderness travel. In fact, in California, the Sierra Club now has made an agreement with the outfitters that when they take cans into the wilderness with pack horses, they could afford to take the cans out again empty. Believe it or not, they've been burying cans so much up there, now you can hardly find a place left in the campgrounds where you don't dig up more cans. And that's the kind of thing, you know, that's coming on and that we have to look forward to. And my only plea is that that we try to work, as you were doing here, to work toward quality of personal, individual experience. I'd like to put it that way. And it seems to me that that is the thing that we need in our country more than anything else. And I hope that if I had one wish, a final wish for people, it would be to have the kind of a summer that we had this summer on the Shinjek. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Murray. We'll look forward to your slides.